Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Sex Trade Ordeal. Listen to the inspirational life story of a former prostitute who quit her job, became a Catholic, and set up a shelter to help other sex workers leave the trade and start a new life. And a peaceful passing. We discover why it's time to banish that image of the hospice as a grim and depressing institution where terminally ill people die in agony. But first, we begin with a report on Pope Benedict's Wednesday General Audience.
Hundreds of people, including pilgrims who had come from as far afield as Nigeria and India, packed the courtyard of the papal summer residence at Castel Gandolfo in the Roman hills for the Holy Father's weekly general audience. A smiling and relaxed Pope Benedict greeted those present enthusiastically, even managing to lift high his arm, which has been in a cast as a result of a fall for the last few weeks. The Pope's catechesis on Wednesday turned to a saint whose feast day is celebrated on August 19th, St. John Udes. The Holy Father described this saint as a man of immense courage and said he had a great understanding for the spiritual mission of the priest.
He lived in 17th century France, which, notwithstanding considerable trials for the faith, produced many outstanding examples of spiritual courage and insight. St. John Udes' particular contribution was the foundation of a religious congregation dedicated to the task of giving solid formation to the diocesan priesthood. He encouraged seminarians to grow in holiness and to trust in God's love revealed to humanity in the priestly heart of Jesus and in the maternal heart of Mary.
Pope Benedict again highlighted the fact that 2009 is the year of the priest and added that both St. John Udes and the year's patron, St. John Vianney, were both shining examples of priestly sanctity. The Pope also looked at the world in which priests live today and said that it was necessary for them to bear witness to the infinite merciful heart of Jesus.
During this year, let us pray in a special way for priests and seminarians, that inspired by today's saint, they may spiritually enter into the heart of Jesus, becoming men of true love, mercy, humility and patience, renewed in holiness and pastoral zeal. My dear brothers and sisters, upon you and your families and all God's blessings of joy and peace.
I'm Lydia O'Kane.
For an inspirational story that sprang from a somewhat unlikely beginning. Prostitution is often described as the oldest profession in the world, and it's arguably one of the most despised. But sex for money exists no matter where one goes in the world, and statistics show that in many countries, business is booming. In the UK, for instance, the number of men who frequent sex workers has nearly doubled in a decade. We hear nowadays how a growing number of those working as prostitutes are the victims of people traffickers who have forced them to become sex slaves. But what about those who have chosen this profession? What are their feelings about their job? And what is the Church's response to prostitution? Well, I've been finding out more.
An abusive life. It was a soul-destroying life. You hate your clients. I hated doing what I did.
Linda Watson is a former prostitute turned campaigner who worked in the sex trade in Western Australia for 20 years, initially as a prostitute and then as a brothel manager or madame. After quitting her job at the brothel, she set up Linda's House of Hope, a shelter that helps other girls to leave the sex trade and start a new life. In 2003, she was named Australia's most inspirational woman by the magazine Woman's Weekly for her work on behalf of others. Linda first got lured into the sex trade by the promise of high earnings when she was an impoverished single mother struggling to support three children. She told me more about her first impressions.
My first client, I guess we always go back to the first client, was a high-profile media executive. I was quite amazed that somebody so powerful, so rich, and in such a high position. And I thought, oh, I had from the butcher to the baker, right to these high-profile people. But I guess you soon learn that most of them lack integrity. 99% of them are married. And you think, wow, hey, what's marriage? There is no trust. Why would you want to get married if your man's going to go to a brothel, huh?
And what were your feelings about them? I mean, did you sometimes feel sorry for them? Did you despise them? Did you fear them?
I guess you switch on and off. I think you learn very quickly that you to survive, you're going to think, I'm just doing this for the money. You know, you could be reading the paper almost. It's just such a cold transaction. So you're not really trying to focus on the person that you're with. You're focusing right at the beginning. We're going back to my beginning thinking, this will make money. I'll do this for a couple of months and I'll get out. And there lies a real danger too, where you just totally switch off.
So you never came across anybody who treated you with even a slight degree of respect?
There's a lot of people who were very, very nice. Also, I learned that they were very insecure and, you know, I'm not a man hater. They also hated themselves for having to pay for it. I guess underneath, they had a problem. There were nice men who would talk to you. There were men who would cry because their wife didn't understand them. And so you think, oh, poor person. But really, the underlying thing is the fact that it was deceitful and they lacked integrity. That I learned very quickly, and I got very disillusioned. The reality is nothing like the Pretty Woman movie.
Linda says the sense of shame was so strong that she tried to conceal what she was doing from those around her.
I mean, I concealed it from nearly everybody that I could think of. I quickly got a nanny in. The money was rolling in. I mean, I was supposed to earn $2,000 a week. I earned $5,000 in my first week. You're certainly not going to tell your kids. But then you sort of think, right, I feel so dirty. And I remember coming home showering, had so many showers because I felt so dirty. And I certainly lost that part of even being a mother because I even when I went to cuddle my kids, I felt so guilty. So I really did shelter them until they were old enough for me to tell them because I was really concerned that there would be somebody that would tell them.
Linda originally only intended to work as a prostitute for 2 months. But as she explains, once you get sucked into the sex trade, it's very difficult to escape.
It was very difficult to get out because the money entrapped me, the lifestyle entrapped me, and I guess I lost who I was. I lost my world, you know, my self-worth. I mean, I knew it wasn't right when I went into it. I went into a whole different sort of a world.
Drug use and prostitution each tend to fuel the other. And Linda says a very high percentage of sex workers become addicted to drugs.
98% of the girls that are working are on drugs. If they come in clean, they're certainly not going to stay clean for very long.
Why is this such a problem?
Because it's an emotional job. It's also the fact that these girls are doing 8 to 15 men a day, and some are doing 20 clients in one shift. So they are needing something to fuel their bodies so that they can continue to do the job. That actually gets them to stay in the sex industry.
But although the vast majority of prostitutes do find it very difficult to leave the sex trade, Linda was able to buck that trend. She told me how one day she decided she'd had enough and wanted to start a new life.
There was a lot of aspects for me leaving the industry. My mother's prayers, for start, she prayed for me for 20 years. She never stopped praying for me to get out of the industry. And I had so many bad experiences. And when Princess Diana died, I guess that was a pivotal moment that I thought, all the money that you can make isn't going to make you rich. I guess there was a whole pile of issues of seeing all the pain and hurt in people's eyes over 20 years and my own pain. I asked for God to help me and his guidance that night, I think August the 31st, 1997. I just said, God, if you're really there, reveal yourself to me. And I couldn't put it more clearer that I cried out for God to help, and he did.
But what was so unusual about Linda was that once she left the sex trade, she didn't forget those she'd left behind. Instead, she decided to go back and rescue others from the sex industry.
I had it's like a passion on my heart, and I guess the other side of it as well is 20 years, who was going to employ me? I was 42 years of age, and I wasn't ready to lie down and not do anything. But I guess the defining moment was that what can I do with my life and what purpose can this serve? And I guess the biggest thing for me was that the government was about to legalise prostitution in Western Australia. And that was the pivotal moment that I sort of said, right, this isn't going to happen. And from there, I had a burning passion to save others and to warn others not to do that. Don't go down that path.
But, as she told me, trying to find support and backing for her idea of opening a shelter to house former prostitutes proved incredibly difficult.
Difficult was an understatement. I had banged on doors for 2 years, and I got to the stage where I sort of went to every possible places that I could think of that I could go, and every door was closing. You know, people were starting to even laugh at the fact that I was still continuing my search for this dream or vision. And I said, I have this passion and vision that I can provide a home, I can do something for people, but everybody's shutting the doors in my face.
But one day, a door was not banged shut in her face, and Linda was given that vital helping hand.
I could not believe how he welcomed me with open arms, and he believed in me, and he believed in my vision, plus fighting against legalisation. He was an answer to my prayers.
The answer to Linda's prayers came in the person of the Catholic Archbishop of Perth, Barry Hickey. It was he who helped her to set up a shelter for former sex workers. Here's his side of the story.
Linda rang me, almost in desperation, saying I was a madam and I pulled out of the industry and I want to rescue girls. Can you help me? I immediately said, I don't know how to help you, but I will help you.
Was it an easy thing to do? Were other people trying to dissuade you from it? I mean, how did you go about it?
Well, I waited for 2 weeks and said I'd call you back, and I did. And by then I'd resolved that if she needed accommodation, I would provide at least one house, and we've been able to do that. And now she has a second house, which is the house where the prostitutes mainly stay. But there was some surprise, a lot of surprise. Some people shook their heads and said, what's he getting into? But generally, the support has been great.
Archbishop Hickey remains actively involved in Linda's project and says through his association, his eyes have been opened to how much the sex trade exploits these women.
I visit the place every couple of months and I meet the girls that are there at any particular time. There are lots of success stories, girls being very grateful that they had a chance to escape that prison of prostitution and have a chance to do some studies, to get some skills and to get other jobs.
And what have you learned on a personal level from your involvement in this project and from your talks with these people who are trying to escape from the world of prostitution? I mean, has it sort of broken down, shall we say, some stereotypes that many of us may harbour about these women?
One of the things Linda has always said is that there is no glamour in prostitution, and I've found that out too. The lives of these girls are anything but glamorous. I've discovered that most of them have entered prostitution against their will. They themselves have been abused in many cases and have very low self-esteem. I've also found out that my opinion of men generally is not that good. They exploit these girls across every section of society. Most of them are unfaithful to their wives. It is not a good scene. There is a lot of exploitation also by the people who control the prostitutes. So I see it as a grimy trade, and I'm glad Linda's there rescuing these girls.
In Britain, Dr. Elaine Storkey is a well-known Christian author and sociologist who is president of the Christian development charity Tear Fund. She has done several studies on prostitution and has been involved in faith-based projects to try to rescue sex workers from the trade. Elaine believes the Christian churches often have a tendency to be too judgmental when it comes to the issue of prostitution. Instead, she says, what is required is a sense of compassion.
Why is it that they're trapped into this lifestyle? Why is it that they have so little respect for their own bodies that they're willing to use them in this kind of way? And I think just talking to women and trying to give them more self-respect and more body sense that's positive rather than negative is also what we can do. I think where we failed a lot is just simply seeing prostitutes as immoral people whom we need to legislate against and hound out of our patch. They're real human beings with great needs and often very bad backgrounds, and we need all the compassion we have to actually work with them.
Elaine told me how even a single kind gesture can succeed in reaching out to what many perceive as hardened sex workers.
There's one project in the UK in an area of London well known for prostitution, where a bunch of churches decided to get together and on Christmas Eve go around all the known prostitutes in the area with a rose, a single red rose, and not with a tract and not with a complaint or anything, just with a rose to say, this is Christ's birthday, we want to share something of what we feel about Jesus Christ and with you, and then leave the rose with them and wish them a happy Christmas and go away. And one of the women who had received a rose spoke to me, and she said it broke her heart. She had no idea that the God that the church believed in was a God who actually loved her. And she had that rose, and she said when it finally died, she just wept and wept and wept because somehow something of herself had gone into that rose. So I think a lot of women are feeling very negative about themselves in the job. A lot of them are struggling to get out. A lot are very, very defensive because they feel they're being judged by others. And then a few do feel that this is a perfectly okay lifestyle and they're going to stay with it. It's very mixed.
Returning to the situation in Australia, how does Archbishop Hickey evaluate the Catholic Church's response to prostitution? And how much help does it provide to those trying to get out of the business?
I would say that only on an individual level is much else being done. Occasionally a prostitute will approach a priest or a convent for help, but that is rare. I think Linda's project in this part of the world is the main contribution that the church is making by supporting her.
So, in your view, a lot more could and should be done?
Yes, I think government and the community generally should support efforts to rescue these girls. The scene here is very different from trafficking that goes on in third world countries or from third world countries to Europe. We have some trafficking here, but not much. Most of the prostitution is by local girls in local brothels controlled by local people.
And when it comes to the men that use prostitutes, is the church speaking out enough against the fact that they should not be doing this, that they are exploiting these women?
I do use opportunities that come my way in the media to say those things, but generally prostitution is glamorized. The image of a prostitute is one who is wealthy, who is having fun, and who wants to be where she is. It's a completely wrong picture. We're doing something, but we're not getting enough publicity because I don't think people believe us.
When you say you don't think people believe us, what do you mean by that?
I mean that they think that if the church speaks out, it's just speaking out about outdated moral code. But when people get close to prostitutes, they see that their lives are very sad indeed. We have very little legislation, so prostitution is on the rise, but we want better legislation to control it, but not to license it.
Why is prostitution on the rise, in your opinion?
I think it's the general culture of the country, where personal freedom is emphasised to such an extent that prostitution is seen to be a man's right, and it's mainly men who look for girls. It's just part of the general culture that people can do what they like, and nobody should put up any moral barriers. Also, it is not generally understood that the girls are harmed by prostitution and exploited, and that's the message we want to put out there to men.
Perhaps not surprisingly, Linda's courageous decision to help rescue girls from the sex trade has earned her many enemies among her former associates in the business. She told me how on numerous occasions she has risked death because of her stand.
When I first left the industry, I spoke to a madam and she threatened me and asked me to leave town, and this wasn't going to happen and she wasn't going to stand for it. And then I got shot at. I've been shot at, firebombed, threats, nearly kidnapped, people nearly through my roof. Can't count the death threats. It's been horrendous.
But you're carrying on.
Absolutely, absolutely. I have my dignity back and I have something worthwhile fighting for, and I believe in what I do.
But regaining her dignity and self-respect is just one of the rewards Linda has found in her new life. A Catholic convert, Linda says her greatest moment came when she met the late Pope John Paul during a visit to Italy in 2004.
Well, I met the Pope. Wow, that was just the best reward that I ever had. I just felt like, oh my God, I'm standing here right in front of the Pope and here I am. It was just like redemption for me. I just felt like Mary Magdalene standing there in front of the Pope. That was my greatest overwhelming, and of course I'd won the most inspirational woman of Australia, and that didn't mean as much as meeting the Pope.
That was the voice of Linda Watson, a former sex worker turned campaigner, and you also heard the voices of Archbishop Barry Hickey of Perth and Elaine Storkey, an expert on prostitution. For most people, the word hospice is associated with pain and suffering, and above all, death. Many of us would not even relish the idea of stepping inside a place that cares for the terminally ill, as few like to dwell too closely on the uncomfortable truth of our own mortality. But as I've been finding out, a hospice nowadays is far from being a grim and depressing institution where terminally ill people die in agony.
This is a place of much love and much laughter and much hope and much faith, and certainly not a place of doom and gloom.
Denise Mulligan is manager of St Michael's Hospice in Hastings, England, and she believes it's high time to discard the typical doom and gloom image of a hospice. The commitment of Denise and the other staff to the patients at the hospice shines through when they speak, and she's quick to point out the rewards and privileges involved in their job.
I think here those of us that work here and dearly love our hospice actually have learnt much from our patients, and we support them and they totally enrich our lives. I think when a person is actually nearing the end of their life that we can actually learn much for the way that people actually live, and I think for us that work in palliative care, we learn something every day from the people that we care for.
With many people automatically equating terminal illnesses with dreadful physical pain, it's not surprising that many patients who first come to any hospice are worried about the agonies they believe must lie in store for them. Maxine Clist is manager of St Augustine's Nursing Home, which is attached to St Michael's Hospice. And she says they do everything possible to ensure that dying is pain-free in every sense of the word.
Absolutely. That is what we're here for. It's not just about their physical pain, it's about their emotional pain as well. And we aim through our multidisciplinary to achieve that for them in the way that they want. They're only going to die once. Our job is to make that as peaceful and as dignified for them as possible. And it's about them allowing them to die the way they want to do.
Denise agrees with Maxine and points out that the quality of palliative care has made enormous strides in recent years.
Certainly palliative care, true palliative care, which is what we offer here at St Michael's Hospice, specialist palliative care, is a very exacting science. You know, diamorphine is certainly one type of analgesia for physical pain, copes particularly with, say, organ pain, but you might get bone pain or nerve pain particularly, which other types of treatment are much more effective. So it's actually that really specialist approach that we offer here at the hospice that offers the best solution.
In addition to removing the pain, Maxine says their motto is to do everything within their power to make their patients' final days as happy as possible. And she told me sometimes they go to incredible lengths to try to satisfy their patients' wishes.
I had a patient who was a breeder of llamas, and her wish was to actually see her llamas before she died. And so we made every arrangement. We got drivers, we got horse boxers, and our only failing at the time was unfortunately due to the foot and mouth restrictions. We weren't able to actually get the llama down. We tried everything possible, and that was enough for her. She knew that we weren't giving up on her wishes.
Even without pain, death is a frightening prospect for most of us. So how much of a comfort is it to have a strong faith in God? The Reverend Robert Langdon is the resident chaplain at St. Michael's Hospice.
Well, my experience is that where people have a faith, it is enormously strengthening and comforting for them. But a large number of people don't have a faith, and that's where we come in. We're there for them. We seek to offer a ministry of love, compassion, sympathy, and hope. And of course, in a large hospice, such gifts are constantly needed.
He says often the real challenge is persuading people to come to terms with and accept the fact that death is inevitable for all of us.
Anthony was a depressed and agitated man, kept asking, what's it all about? What's the purpose of it all? Why? But a gentle, caring ministry of our whole team, in the end, brought about a peace and a calm and an acceptance. And I noticed that anxiety and fear disappeared from his face during those last days, and he died a peaceful death.
Maxine says emotional pain is sometimes the toughest nut of all to crack when trying to help people come to terms with their own mortality.
We've had some very tough cases. Probably the hardest ones are the ones with emotional pain. I had a gentleman who was a squadron leader in the Second World War, and he saw his whole squadron of young men burnt to death on a raid. And this haunted him all the way through his life. And this came back to him time and time again as a dream. He would be climbing steps, and when the door opened, there would be a big, large fire there that he had to step into. And this was representing what his death was going to be for him. With very, very gentle work through all members of the team, we helped him to come to terms. And I got a call in the middle of the night. And I came in and I went into his room. And his face was just so different. And he then described to me the dream that he had had that night. He climbed up the stairs and he opened the door. And instead of there being fire there, there was a big, beautiful blue sky. And he now knew that death was something that was going to be peaceful and it wasn't going to hurt. And in actual fact, Ian died 2 days afterwards, taking no more painkillers than paracetamol, because his emotional pain had gone now.
But is it tough for them emotionally, looking after people who they know are destined not to be around for much longer? Maxine again.
It can be, but as a team, we work together as a team. We all recognise that there's going to be a patient that's going to push a button in us more than anyone else. And so as a team, we rally together, we support each other. But it's not all darkness, because we have those patients alongside the ones who have got problems who are playing rock and roll music to 4 in the morning, you know, celebrating their life. And so we're part of that. So there is this balance going on all the time with happiness and sadness. But at the end of the day, if our patients have died peacefully, with dignity and with acceptance, then the stress isn't there because we've done our bit.
Do you consider that those are the rewards of your job, or are there other ones as well?
I think the reward for me is knowing that a patient has died, accepting that death is there, that they are embracing it, that they are pain-free, they're symptom-free, and more importantly, that the family are there as well, that they have accepted that this is going to happen, that we can't change the inevitable. Yes, there will be sadness, but if we can help reduce that for them by a degree of acceptance and through lots and lots of love in our community, that's where my satisfaction comes from.
That was Maxine Clist, and you also heard the voices of the Reverend Robert Langdon and Denise Mulligan, all from St. Augustine's Hospice in Hastings, England.
Well, that's all from Vatican Radio's English programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. Laudato Jesus Christus.